This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, a look at local efforts to fight the heroin crisis and provide help to those addicted to drugs. But first, journalist Sam Quinones has been tracking the rise in addiction to prescription painkillers and heroin that's been sweeping across the country, devastating families and communities. In his book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, he looks at the origins of the heroin crisis and its dramatic growth. Sam will be speaking at Northern Kentucky University next week, and I recently spoke with him about his book and what he's learned about the heroin epidemic. Sam, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Tell me about the title of the book. Why did you decide to call it Dreamland?
That developed really well into the book. Into my research. I didn't really plan on it initially. I didn't really have a good title initially, honestly. But I discovered the story of this magnificent swimming pool in the town of Portsmouth, Ohio, that seemed almost to encapsulate a lot of what the book had become, because I started this book thinking this was a book about drugs and crime, and it was a kind of classic drug and crime book. And I began to realize as I got into it that really it was about something much larger, about what we'd become, who we'd become, and as Americans, and also what we had done to community, and how we had destroyed community. And when you destroy community, you allow a drug as isolating, and we're just as isolating as opiates and heroin to enter. And so the story of how this glorious swimming pool in Portsmouth, Ohio, called Dreamland, that was the name of the pool, had been kind of the center of life, the place where everyone saw each other, the place where kids grew up, the place where everyone watched each other. It was a very egalitarian place because everyone kind of looked the same in swim trunks. There was a place that kept growing too. There was always room for more people. The owners of the pool kept on buying more property, and then there was picnic tables and baseball and basketball and just large grassy areas. So it seemed like there was always room for more. And then in 1980, the decline came to Portsmouth, Ohio. They had a steel factory. It left. Several other factories left. Of course, a lot of people began to leave. And of course, then also their bustling Main Street began to die. And finally, several years later, they had to close, and finally it was dug up and replaced with basically a large strip mall, a big sea of asphalt, and an O'Reilly's auto parts store. And with that, the town lost, I felt, with all the loss of all that, it also lost its kind of societal immune system, the bulwark that would allow it to defeat certain societal problems and ills. And in that area, it so happened that the rise of prescription painkillers was, you know, they were being promoted and marketed very, very heavily during those years. And in time, the pills just came kind of washed over Portsmouth, Ohio, and it became really very famously, I think, the pill mill capital of the country. In a small town, by then it lost half its population. 20,000 people remain, and something like a dozen pain pill clinics, or pill mills really is what they were, arrived. A new business model. It was one of the few locally owned businesses that opened in those years in that town. And in time, it became a center of pill distribution for one of the big ones in the country. But I found the story of Dreamland, the swimming pool, as part of this larger story of what's happened to the country, that when you destroy community, when you destroy the things that give your community sustenance and life and hold it together, like the jobs, like the factories, like Main Street, but also like the swimming pool that really held things together, then you become extraordinarily vulnerable as a community or as a region to these pills. And I think this is largely what has happened, that we have done this in various forms all across the country, and has left us very vulnerable to the spread of these pills.
Sam, there was a good intent behind prescription painkillers. They were meant to alleviate human suffering.
Right.
How do we reach a point where they're causing so much suffering?
You're right. It's absolutely true that there was a good reason for making easier the prescribing of these pills, because for many years, for decades in this country, we prescribed almost none. Doctors were terrified of addicting their patients. And so even in the most egregious cases of people in completely indecent pain, dying of cancer with only 3 months to live or 6 months to live, doctors would still not prescribe those pills. And so there grew up in this country a feeling like that was not right, and they were correct. And so they began to argue for more aggressive prescribing of these drugs. The problem was it didn't stop. It kept going. They kept pushing and pushing, and eventually it became, we need these pills prescribed for all manner of pain. And not only that, we began to believe that these pills were, when used for treating pain, quote, virtually non-addictive. That was the idea, that these things we now knew, that these were now virtually non-addictive when used to prescribe pain. So doctors began prescribing huge amounts of these pills. And in time, people began demanding more and more, particularly as they grew dependent on these pills. They would demand, and their dosage rose and rose and rose. And so you began to have just an enormous amount of supply of these pills out in the country, all over and every part of the country, because it was doctors who grew to believe this. And there's a whole lot more doctors. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of doctors across this country. So their belief that these were now virtually non-addictive for all manner of pain when treated for pain became kind of like the conventional wisdom. And in fact, a lot of people don't have a problem when using these pills. But the fact is, too, that they are not virtually non-addictive. They're extraordinarily addictive. And a lot of people, when using the pills exactly the right way, have grown addicted to them and have had their lives destroyed.
So what's the link between pills and heroin? How do we transition from a problem with prescription pill abuse to a problem with heroin?
Well, these are all opiates. Painkillers, heroin is too. That's all. They all come from the opium poppy or drugs that are derived from the opium poppy. So the drugs in OxyContin and Vicodin and Percocet, two drugs in particular, oxycodone and hydrocodone, those are just simply synthetic opiates. They're chemically and molecularly very similar to heroin. They have the same molecular structure. They have the same effect on the brain, the same euphoria, the same painkilling attributes. And, of course, the same addictive capacity. And so what has happened is that people get addicted to the pills. People who never, ever before that would have said to you, yes, one day I'll end up a heroin addict. That's just completely out of the realm of their conception. And would get addicted to these pills. And in time, for one reason or another, and the reasons are many, they would either lose their prescription, the doctor would stop prescribing, they would be doing this recreationally. A lot of people got addicted using these things recreationally, abusing them essentially. And the price of the pills on the street is fairly hefty. It's $1 a milligram. And so heroin now comes from Mexico, and it's extraordinarily cheap now, cheaper than heroin has ever been before, when most of our heroin came from the East. So the switch when you're paying $100, $150, $200 a day in pills to heroin that is the same effect, much cheaper, is almost kind of like what many addicts told me, you know, was, quote, a no-brainer. And so basically people have been making that switch. We've seen this transition really accelerate, you know, in the last couple, 3 years, maybe 4 years or so. But I would argue that this transition is not new at all. It's been happening since we've been heavily prescribing pain pills, going back to the late 1990s. I found people doing that in smaller numbers, to be sure. But nevertheless, these transitions from prescription pain pills to heroin has been going on for quite some time now, and it's not a new thing.
So it seems like, though, we have this perfect storm going on, painkiller abuse and heroin making a comeback. Was this all a coincidence, or did the heroin traffickers see an opportunity here?
That's a real good question, and I don't believe that there was a conspiracy.
But it sounds like they were clever marketers, and they being clever marketers, they saw, hey, people are addicted to this expensive expensive pills, and we have an opportunity to move in and take some of that business.
Exactly. And for many years before that, in every market of the country, if there was any heroin at all, it was a very static market of addicts, but not a lot of growth. You had the same people remaining addicted and using heroin for many years, and there was not a lot of new addicts added to that. And so with pills, though, it became very clear. It was a very easy thing to see, I think, for a lot of guys on the street, all of a sudden you get all these new people, and they have money. Most heroin addicts from the old days are pretty tapped out. They don't have a lot of cash. They're living in motels, or they're just kind of living hand to mouth. The new class of addicts usually has far more resources. And so traffickers began to figure that out. The guys that I write about in my book are all from one town. They are master marketers, these guys. They have devised a system through great trial and error over many years that allows them to be really tremendous marketers of this, and therefore very attuned to the market, to seeing what was new and what was happening. And not even all of them understood what was going on, because they're from Mexico. They speak Spanish. They're not having long conversations with the addicts, but a few of them who did speak English, did figure this out and did say, if particularly when they began to expand, they began to expand east of the Mississippi River in the late 1990s, just as this pill and pain revolution was underway. And they began to see this, and they began to understand, if we just go where the pills are, eventually we will have an entirely new market of people to sell our heroin to, because the transition is going to happen. And so that's pretty much what they did. They landed in Columbus first. And then from there, from Columbus, they began to spread. And Cincinnati was one place they spread to, but also Nashville, Indianapolis, Charlotte, South Carolina, various places like that. All thinking that all of these, by the way, is areas where the drug world has no entrenched armed gangs that they had to deal with. You know, it's a very, very kind of easy drug world to navigate. And so they began to do that and follow where the pills could be a problem. And that's where they'd set up. And they were right. Eventually, an entirely and much, much, much larger new population of opiate addict was created. And many of them became heroin users.
What was the place in Mexico where this all originated?
The town that I write about is a town called Jalisco. And it's in the state of Nayarit. Nayarit is one of Mexico's smallest states. These guys figured out this marketing tool, which was to say that they began to figure that if we would deliver heroin, instead of just setting up in the classic sense, which is what heroin traffickers have almost always done, but these guys said if we begin to deliver, that then they would find far more clients, but they'd also be far less obvious to the police. And what also made these guys in particular, a lot of people began to do this kind of delivery model, but what made these guys most important to this story is that they began to expand. They started in the San Fernando Valley of LA, but they didn't just stay there. A lot of people just stay in their area because they were saturated their area, and they all knew each other. They all knew each other, these crews that would set up. Operating very much like a Domino's pizza, where, you know, the addict would call a number and an operator would take the order, and the operator would call a driver, and the driver would have his heroin with him and drive over to where the addict happened to be. That was basically the system, very much like pizza delivery. These guys began to expand.
So they were built around customer service?
Yeah, exactly. They began to expand on the western side of the United States. In the very time when there was no expansion of the opiate addict market, and so they would go into a market, and pretty soon there'd be two or three crews, and they'd all be competing, but they couldn't kill each other. They're all from the same town. They all know each other. They all know where each other's mothers live. You know, you just can't kill each other, and that's the way drug traffickers have often carved out market share. Right. Well, these guys had to devise other ways of taking customers from each other and devising and creating market share for themselves. And so they began to discount and offer come-ons, like, if you get me three new clients, I'll give you 10 new balloons, free balloons. If you buy from me every day, Monday through Saturday, I'll give you a free one on Sunday. And these kind of mechanisms or strategies or techniques, they developed because there was no expanding drug market. There was just a group of addicts in every town, say Salt Lake City or Denver, Portland or Reno or someplace or Vegas. And so they developed this and refined this system for many years before they made that hop across the Mississippi River in the late 1990s and stumbled into, very, very coincidentally, just stumbled into the Columbus market, which was then, of course, beginning to explode with opiate addicts because of all this heavy promotion of these pills. And they brought their system and their very relentless marketing with them. And they, you know, basically, I think there may be eight or nine crews now from this town working the Columbus market. There's two or three, I think. The last I heard, there was three or four, I think, in Cincinnati. They come and they go. It's never static. It's always, you know, changes by the month, I think. But it's Cincinnati is a well-known market to them. From Cincinnati, of course, that, you know, they figured out Indianapolis and Nashville and Memphis and places like that as well. And so it's a marketing tool. It's a business model that they can replicate and have replicated in many places. All of these towns are characterized by very light, you might say, a gang or street dealer or mafia control of the drug market and a growing number of opiate addicts.
I'm talking with Sam Quinones. His book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Sam's going to be speaking at Northern Kentucky University Monday evening at 7. Sam, what is the toll? How do you describe the toll that this drug abuse, prescription and heroin abuse, how widespread is it? How much suffering is it causing in this country?
Well, I have to say I believe it's coast to coast. I have to believe it's in almost every part of the country, because remember, this is the first drug scourge that we've had that was not created, not instigated or ignited by street drug dealers. It was ignited by a change in habit and custom and practice of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of doctors all across the country. That's changing. I think a lot of doctors are really coming to reexamine how they prescribe those pills. But there's no doubt in my mind that this is what started all the problem that we have. And because doctors are everywhere, and they generally bought into this new conventional wisdom, we have this problem all over the country. I've received emails since my book has been out from, well, just recently, a sheriff in Massachusetts, Juneau, Alaska, Virginia, Tennessee, Oregon, you know, all over the country, and also, I have to say, places that never had a heroin problem before, and now most clearly do. And so, I mean, the death toll is greater than any other drug scourge we've ever had. I think 47,000, I think the number for 2014 was 47,000 drug overdoses, and I believe that's a serious undercounting. And the death toll is only part of the story. I have to say that any family out there, and I'm sure if any are listening now, they can understand this, they are led through years of torment and torture trying to deal with the addiction of one loved one in that family. And one addiction just seems to consume an entire family. And so even before the child may die, it's almost like a living hell. And I believe this is happening, though, all across the country.
Yeah, so it's fair when the term epidemic is used around this, that's a good description.
There's the classic thing we've all heard now. Drug overdoses have surpassed the number of traffic fatalities. And to me, that would be pretty much in the definition of an epidemic, if that's happening. I mean, never in the history of the automobile in America has that been the case. For decades, people in public health grew used to the idea that the number one accidental cause of death in America was always traffic fatalities. And that changed. A change in Ohio, I believe in 2008, I can't remember if it was 2007 or 2008, and a year or so later, it changed nationally. And so that must have been, many of the moments in this book strike me, but one moment must have been when two public health workers from the Department of Health in the state of Ohio began crunching the numbers and began to understand that within about a couple of months, it was very likely that in the state of Ohio, the numbers of traffic fatalities would be surpassed by the number of fatal drug overdoses, and that this was an unprecedented moment in the history of public health in modern America. So that's what we've been living with ever since.
Sam, coming back to Portsmouth, Ohio, do you see any signs of hope coming from this town that give us clues on fighting this problem?
Oh, yes. I was going to spend only two visits. I'm going to only visit twice that town. I felt, well, I was going to tell the story of the pill mills. That was my initial plan. And the more I kept going back, though, the more I began to realize that this town, this classic Rust Belt town that had lost so much, lost people, lost jobs, lost economy, lost a lot of hope and optimism and energy, and then seen it all replaced with abandoned houses and despair and fatalism. That's even before the pills arrive. And along comes the most destructive, insidious virus of opiate addiction that just takes with it an entire generation of that town. The more I visited, though, the more I began to realize, you know, I think there's something else happening here that's not so easy to discover, but if I stick with it, I think what's happening is this town is beginning to recover, and it's very much like an addict hitting rock bottom and then seeing the only way is up, that this town is beginning to shrug off, in a way, the culture of dependency, of somebody else coming in and helping it, or dependency simply on something else, in this case, dope. And it began with it began in several places. You can't say it started one place. One thing, though, that happened was the state of Ohio, as you know, in 2011 passed a bill regulating pain clinics. And so for the first time, you could not be a felon and run a pain clinic. Before that, you could. With that, the DEA came in and closed down all those nasty pain clinics. And at the same time, you began to see a new attitude with regard to job loss. They were going to lose a shoelace manufacturer, the very last shoe factory, connected factory in that town. And people stepped in and said, you know what, we've been allowing this to happen. We've been saying, oh, well, to this job departure for too long. And several business people in the town stepped in and bought this shoelace manufacturer out of bankruptcy and saved that company. And it's now employing 60, 80 people, I believe. I can't remember exactly. But it was a beautiful story of leaving behind that dependency culture of saying, oh, well, what can we do? The fatalism and all, and saying, we're going to begin to take the reins of our own future, ourselves. And they began by, they saved that company. They began to, they got rid of those pain clinics. And this being a story of drug supply, once you get rid of all that supply, then addicts have a fighting chance to recover. Instead of being just greeted by just massive amounts of pills, they can then begin to recover. And when I was, the last few times I visited, I eventually went there six times, I began to see there was like this recovery culture was forming. So a competing culture to the idea of, well, let's just get high and steal the copper wire from the school district. A competing culture was growing up to say, no, let's be clean. Let's work. Let's reinvent ourselves. And it was people getting off dope and finding hope. And it was a beautiful, I have to say, it was a beautiful, exhilarating, very American story that I found of this town beaten by 30 years of all kinds of problems. Now saying, I think we're going to try to do it on our own here and doing it. It was a beautiful, and it's underway in Portsmouth. I think Portsmouth is the place where people who have gone through this thing need to pay attention to. It's a town that just made me kind of get emotional very much as I began to discover this story that was not all about fatalism and despair and destruction and degradation. It was what happens. People don't just sit there and take it, I guess, is the moral of the story. Eventually, they begin to say, no, we have to act on our own. And that's what the folks in Portsmouth are doing. So the last few years, I think there's something like 10% of the population, 2,000 people more or less, are in recovery for opiate addiction. Now, there still is a serious drug problem. There's now a very serious heroin problem. I don't want to minimize that, but the story is there as well, that kind of what you do when you're faced with a drug that turns everybody into kind of isolated zombies. Well, you begin to come together as a community, and that is what is happening in Portsmouth in a very exciting way, I think.
Well, Sam, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, Mark, really my pleasure. Thanks so much. Appreciate your interest.
Sam Quinones, his book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. He'll be speaking at Northern Kentucky University Monday evening and Tuesday. And there's a link to more information about those events at WVXU.org. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about the heroin epidemic facing our region. This is Cincinnati Edition. Thanks to Candy Sinks for listening to 91.7 WVXU today.